This magic is old as the Empire itself, Teo assured her. We will not fail. All is not lost. Apari snorted. When the Pale Rider sees us, he will not doubt us again. He thinks he is powerful. He knows nothing of our real power. This will stop all of his complaining and show the reach of the widow's bite.
Then Apari gazed around at her assembled rebels. Their numbers grew each day, slowly but surely. More of the Zandalari and Azaralar and the surrounding villages leaving homes behind to join their ranks. News spread of their attack on the palace. Talanji had made an appearance in the marketplace afterward, quelling rumours that she had been killed in the assassination attempt, but many reported she looked unwell. If the widow's bite could threaten the queen herself, then they were not just an upstart insurrection, but a true danger to the crown. They could not allow her to gather any allies to her side. Zandalar must be cut off, isolated, made vulnerable so that it could again be made strong.
We all stand ready!
Apari raised her arms, and the members of the widow's bite grew silent with awe.
It will take all our power, all our considerable might, to shake the seas and command the clouds.
Before her, a nobleman from the palace lay on a flat, polished piece of black rock. He squirmed. Dars, Apari's dreadtick, perched on his chest, fangs chattering. The old troll, his eyes big and round as moons, had been tightly gagged, and his muffled protests were drowned by Apari's voice. They had taken his fine robes and jewels to trade with passing merchants for food and weapons.
Chant with me now, brothers and sisters. I need your voices. Let the heavens hear ya. Let your will be known.
30 or so trolls sat perched in that circle around Apari, their backs to the vultures circling over the pass. The moon flashed bright and red, drenched in blood as if it had predicted their purpose. Her followers wore loose black tunics and loincloths slashed with white stripes to mimic a spider's many legs. Some wore carved talismans, and others fearlessly allowed fat, furry tarantulas to crawl freely over their shoulders. The chanting began slowly, Apari conducting her followers with broad sweeps of her arms. Teo walked the circle, painted on the dark, flat stones, the narrow plateau above the pass serving as their ritual altar. Not far below, hewing closely to the rocks, they had made a temporary camp, pushed out of their swamp caves by increasingly paranoid royal patrols. She beheld her faithful followers, hungry, tired, hunted from one end of Zandalar to the other. Many had eaten only bone broth and paper-thin bat wings for days now. It did not matter. They would not stop. Their starved bellies made them wild and reckless, and that suited Apari just fine. The Pale Rider Nathanos would join them soon with his rangers to plan the final blow against Talanji and her cursed Loa, and then there would be no escape for the traitor queen. Even the seas would churn with the fury of the widow's bite. Apari limped to the old troll at the centre of the white circle, while Teo lit the 8 ritual torches. White flames blossomed like pale flowers, the acrid smoke mingling with the incense and the stink of sweat pouring off the noble. Apari paused, dagger at her side, wondering what the sacrifice must think of her. She knew him, knew his family, but that did not matter. Once, Apari had been just as rich and noble, as beautiful as the old troll's young daughter, held to be even more desirable than Talanji herself. Her hair had spilled like a clear silver waterfall over one shoulder, braided intricately, pink flowers and beads winking out from between the strands. General Jack Rosette had often praised her smooth green skin and slender arms.
"Arms made for dancing," he would say,
teasing her as she flitted down the palace halls. But those comments, those smooth, slender arms and flowery braids felt like a cruel joke. Now she never washed that silver hair, her eyes hidden behind a half mask. The wound in her leg festered and oozed, pungent with malodor. The infection was nothing she or her physicians had seen, resistant to magic and to poultices, a wound more of the heart and mind than the body, some shaman told her to her face, as if she were the one responsible for its refusal to heal. Only months had passed since her world was shattered, her future stolen from her, and her body broken. But those had been the truest months, the months that defined her. No more frivolities, no more games. The widow's bite was her purpose now, her mother's legacy her only concern.
"You won't be needing this anymore," Apari said, kneeling with difficulty.
She snatched the gag from the troll's mouth, and at once he began pleading.
"You do not need to do this. Do you want gold? I can give you gold. Please, please, Pari, I know you. It is me, Besime. You must know me. There is no need for all of this. I will give you whatever you want. My daughter is to be married soon. Let me live to see it."
"Ah," Apari teased cruelly. "You give your daughter away. Then this be a mercy.
Keep your gold and your promises, sacrifice. But don't be stingy with your screams."
Apari raised the ritual knife and then brought it down with a true strike, piercing the heart, bringing forth the blood, the fuel. Magic had its costs.
"Navre, forgive me."
His thin voice ebbed as his eyes rolled back, and the fuel for the storm began to run into the rivulets carved in the stone. The pain in her leg no longer bothered Apari, a surge like lightning throwing her to her feet. Those arms made for dancing were raised to the moon, and the thrilled cries of her followers felt as intoxicating as the blood magic.
"By flowing, foaming blood, we call the sea to rise," Apari thundered.
Teo lifted her torch, the flame hitting its zenith, each time the crowd chanted,
"Blood! Blood! Blood!"
The blood racing toward the painted symbol ignited, crackling, and the ground all around Apari's feet began to hum and glow.
"By wind from dead lungs, we call the clouds to seethe! Wind! 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 Blood be fire! Fire burn bright! Light the skies and show us your might!"
Apari closed her hands into fists, the white flames rising around her, travelling from the runnels in the stone to the white painted symbol and back to the sacrifice at the centre of it all. Her clothes caught fire first, curling. Teo held her torch high, and the chanting became erratic, her followers leaping and dancing, laughing and twirling one another as the flames abruptly snuffed themselves out. The wind died down. All was quiet, until the fire burned anew, now in Apari's hands. A distant rumble to the east announced their success. Soon the skies above the Zandalari coast would thicken with black clouds, the waves below towering taller than ships. Apari brought her palms together, smothering the magic until it hissed and dulled. And for a moment, with that power still rolling through her veins and her followers celebrating, she knew happiness. The body before her, charred and still, was nothing now but a gift for the buzzards. Teo brought her torch and a smile to Apari, putting her free hand on the troll's shoulder. Hers was more a reserved jubilation.
Yasma would be proud.
Nodding, Apari watched her dreadtick pace listlessly next to the still smouldering body.
I know.
Sighing, she clucked her tongue, and the tick buzzed up into the air, then flew a crooked path to her shoulder, landing there with a nip at her ear.
Patience, little one. Don't be sad now.
When the traitors lie dead at our feet, you will have your feast.
Chapter 11. Arathi Highlands. Ilaria, Turalian, have you found anything? The whistling vortex of the portal twisted shut behind her, and Jaina Proudmore stepped out onto the sand, salt and spray greeting her. She had come with all haste, sent by the King of Stormwind, Turalian and Ilaria's lack of progress concerning him. Days had passed with no word from the pair, no indication that the tip sending them to the Highlands had borne fruit. Jaina had tried to counsel him toward patience, but none of her assurances, none of her arguments, eased his troubled heart. A human man sprawled on the ground, shook helplessly as a dark, shadowy cloud enveloped his head, golden shackles holding him against his will. Turalian was the first to turn and face her, the paladin's concentration breaking, the glittering chains pressing the man into the sand, vanishing in a puff of light. Jaina Proudmore knew that some wielded the light and void seamlessly, but she had never seen such methods used as coercion.
Horrible, she thought. What has possessed them?
Perhaps Anduin was wise to send her after all.
This man and his family sheltered one of the Banshee Queen's dark rangers, then smuggled her to a shipping boat, Turalian told her.
Ilaria did not acknowledge her presence, apparently too busy drawing agonized screams from the smuggler to stop and answer Jaina. A small outpost had been built not far from the shore, and a smattering of Alliance soldiers waited there, lingering in the doorway. Down the beach, a handful of void elves kept solemn watch over what appeared to be the rest of the smuggler's family, all of them on their knees, cowering.
And you know this how?
Jaina pressed, joining Turalian and Ilaria on the damp and shifting sand near the surf.
Did he resist?
The father refused to answer questions, but he possessed a suspicious dagger.
And here Turalian produced the blade, its handle finely wrought with a raised silver skull, purple gems glittering along the hilt.
A dagger that would look more fitting in a forsaken scabbard, don't you agree?
Jaina took hold of their evidence, examining it closely. She could not deny that it resembled the weapons used by Sylvanas and her chosen guards.
A group of refugees led us here. Their apothecary treated the ranger for wounds and then she left for the coast. Vizrin is the ranger. Do you know her?
Turalian asked. A cutting wind streaming up from the south bit at Jaina's skin, fluttering her blue and gold cloak. It might have given her a chill, but she already shivered, mistrustful of the void, disgusted by what she now watched Ilaria do to the smuggler. Many looked on, including Turalian's Alliance forces. Some even squirmed, seemingly sharing Jaina's discomfort.
I don't know her. Jaina replied, returning the blade. That is no matter, he said with a shrug. We will find her soon enough.
The smuggler went silent and limp, perhaps dead, curled into a ball on the sand while the foamy waves lapped at his boots. Illyria inhaled deeply, her eyes lit with strange excitement as she at last ended her cruel work and turned to address them.
"Yes, we will find her soon," Illyria nodded, satisfied. They provided a skiff sturdy enough to sail deep water. The Fool Ranger was quite specific. It must get her west.
Illyria glanced between Jaina and Tyrallian.
"The only thing worth sailing to directly west of here is the Zandalari coast."
Jaina could not argue with the results of their use of both light and void, but she certainly could argue with the method. They seemed distant, numb, as if this was something they had reluctantly done before. Jaina was left hoping it was a desperate measure taken in response to limited time, not their new normal. And time was limited. Searching every corner of Azeroth remained a massive undertaking, and the longer they looked, the less likely they were to find Sylvanas before she caused more death and mayhem.
"Does the king know you are employing these," Jaina groped for the diplomatic word,
"tactics?" At last the poor man on the ground moved, his hands clawing listlessly at the wet sand. The wind carried the full-bodied sobs of his wife and son toward them.
"The king was quite clear," Illyria answered. "We were to use whatever means necessary to extract information. Now we know Sylvanas has her sights set on Zandalar. Our scope has narrowed, and I can only imagine King Anduin will be pleased." "If this is how we must behave to achieve victory, then he is not pleased," Jaina assured them in a hiss, gesturing to the broken smuggler. "Nor am I."
"I assure you, all will make sense in time, Jaina."
Tyrallian spoke before Illyria could spit out whatever she had ready, though the void touched elf's face froze on a snarl.
"Illyria did not harm him overmuch, and the light will soothe whatever now ails him. I will see to that. I would never let the void within her rage out of control."
"And I would never need him to control me."
"Indeed." Jaina pushed past them both, kneeling beside the trembling smuggler. Carefully she rolled him onto his back, cradling his neck with one hand, her eyes seeking along his face for any hint of recognition.
"He has told me everything," Illyria continued impatiently. "To dawdle here with him is to waste precious time."
"I'm sorry."
The words dribbled out between thin, bluish lips, as if Illyria had stolen the last trace of warmth from his body.
"My family. I couldn't feed them. The storms have kept the fish away."
"And a dagger that fine would fetch a tempting price," Jaina finished for him. "When it comes to those we love, we always do what we must. Your honesty is your penance, sir. So I tell you now, if you have anything more to say." Illyria sighed, but the smuggler in Jaina's grasp pawed at the air, nodding frantically.
The ranger. She must reach her destination before the White Lady is full,"
the man whimpered, his eyes rolling back.
"After, no ships will pass."
"What did he say?"
Tyrallian demanded, his heavy boots making sand fly as he hurried to join them.
"What did he say about the sea?"
Jaina frowned, gently placing the man's head back on the unforgiving pillow of the shore. "No ships will pass." It was compassion and not torture that produced the final warning. Perhaps the man might have told them all he knew willingly if only a bit more patience had been utilized.
"When is the next full moon?"
Taken aback, Tyrallian whispered something under his breath, frowning as he made the quick calculations.
6 days.
careful not to disturb the smuggler further. Jaina stood and marched back to Illaria, who had crossed both arms across her chest. Watching the mage with naked suspicion, one feathery eyebrow cocked, her lips pulled into a crooked smile. "We have but 6 days to reach Zandalar safely," Jaina repeated. "I will return to Stormwind at once and relay all of this to the king." Not missing the subtle emphasis she placed on all of this, Illaria shifted to her right, standing exactly where Jaina had meant to place her portal. The two women locked eyes, and Jaina felt a chill prickle in her palms, a warning from her own instincts that if she did not leave soon, they might descend into a true argument. "Is this truly our highest priority, Jaina?" Illaria whispered, mindful of the soldiers observing them. "Tattling?" Jaina tossed back her long braid of hair and conjured her portal, summoning it uncomfortably near to Illaria's back. "All will make sense in time, Illaria," she said, using Tyrallian's own condescending implication. "I go only to appraise King Anduin of your progress, and to tattle." Jaina waited until the elf stepped aside, allowing her to stride quickly toward the portal. She did not trust the void, and she could not trust anyone practically possessed by it. Anduin couldn't possibly know the extent of what Illaria and Tyrallian were doing in his name, and he would never condone it. They were setting a dangerous precedent. She returned to Stormwind City with all possible haste, though her thoughts only grew darker along the way. How could they justify abusing light and void together in such a way? A paladin of Tyrallian's experience and wisdom ought to know better. Illaria ought to know better too. And yet, through their strange alchemy of light and shadow, they had found the most usable information thus far in the campaign to hunt down Sylvanas. When she arrived in the city, her priority remained Anduin. Jaina stormed into the throne room of Stormwind Keep, finding the king was not there to hear petitions. Two armoured sentinels in blue and gold livery near the throne directed her to the map room. Jaina Proudmoore was, after all, a fixture in the castle, both friend and advisor to the young king. Her cloak billowed behind her as she skirted around the ever-present crush of nobles, soldiers, and visitors filling the throne room. She was not at all surprised to find Anduin hunched over the immense, yellowed map of Azeroth, strewn with books and smaller charts, the king of Galnaeus at his side. She was, however, loath to tell them both what she had witnessed, as Ghen Greymane's temper flared readily, even more so since the armistice. But Anduin brightened at her appearance, his blue eyes twinkling with what seemed to her like much-needed hope. "Please," was his first word to her. She braced. "Please tell me you bring good news." Jaina produced her crystal-topped staff with a wave of her right hand, snatching it up deftly and pointing with its brass end to the sea separating the Eastern Kingdoms from the troll continent of Zandalar. "We have 6 days to catch a fishing boat headed for Eastern Zandalar," she told them with clipped efficiency. The macabre fate of their smuggler source could wait. "When the full moon comes, the waters in that pass will become impossible to sail. A dark ranger called Vizrin told all of this to the smuggler that outfitted her with a ship." Anduin's eyes danced even brighter, and he slammed a joyful fist down on the map table. "At last! At last! We will summon Matthias Shaw. He will be the best choice to give chase. His sea legs are stronger after our long campaign in Kul Tiras." Greymane expressed a gruff agreement.
"I have no objections, but should we not send a larger force?"
"We cannot risk alerting the Horde to our presence there," Jaina replied. Zandalar is under their protection.
Our ships in the area would be one thing, but making landfall might be seen as an act of aggression. Jaina is right. The armistice is too fragile, and we cannot survive another war right now. Precautions must be taken, and Matthias can be but a shadow when he desires. The king clapped Gen Greymane several times on the back. Go, find him! With his cunning and a tied sage's magic, we may yet catch this dark ranger. We must pray for good fortune and haste. Greymane bowed to Jaina on his way out, leaving her with a hurried,
Lord Admiral.
She fiddled with the anchor charm dangling around her neck, picking her next words carefully while Anduin leaned excitedly over the map, nearly touching his nose to the great sea. Time to dash this brief lift in his spirits. Anduin, she spoke softly, cautiously, wary of any prying ears and eyes that might be lingering outside the door. I have concerns.
We all do. These are concerning times. Anduin almost laughed, but then he craned his head back, still half embracing the table.
Jaina, what is it? You look truly troubled. Jaina sighed through her nose. There was little point in stalling. He had to know what she had witnessed. For all the lion strength Anduin possessed, he was also gifted with a compassionate heart, a rare combination in a leader, and so it pained her to speak ill of those he respected. Illaria and Turalyon tortured that smuggler in front of me. She used the void to infiltrate his mind, while he held him prisoner with chains made from the light. It looked unspeakably painful. She rounded the table, searching his face. My king, I worry that their tactics represent you poorly. Every one of us, every soldier, is in service to your crown. We stand under your banner. And if their actions are sanctioned by your rule, what does that say about us?
Anduin did not speak for a long while, though his smile diminished. He shook his head, turning away from her, pacing back and forth across the lush green carpet beneath their feet. Finally, he crossed to a large brazier in the corner, belching healthy flames. Flattening his hand, he passed it back and forth just above the reach of the fire.
What does it say? He echoed.
He sounded almost offended that she had to ask.
It says we will do whatever we must to bring murderers to justice. It says we will not forget those lost in war.
It says we will not forget Teldrassil or Lordaeron. It says we will not forget the Makgora.
It says we will not forget the flames blazing over the veiled sea or the fires reflected in the eyes of 1,000 mourning children.
His hand closed into a fist. With every word, his determination grew, rising and rising, a crescendo that nearly reached a shout. Then he glanced at her out of the corner of his eye, and his voice dropped to a whisper.
There was a time not so long ago when you were not above swinging the harsh hammer of retribution. I have not forgotten, Jaina. Have you?
Oh, great lion. Your heart is becoming steel. Hers had once done the same, hardened by the bomb that destroyed Theramore, and that rigidity had ruled her for a time, not only her powers, but her heart and her mind encased in frost. Vividly, sadly, she remembered telling Varian in no uncertain terms that the Horde must be utterly annihilated. It had taken a long time for her to thaw, and remnants of that icy anger still lingered, making her all the more able to detect it in others. She saw it then in Anduin, a grief like all-encompassing cold. Jaina, he prompted her, but she felt no rush to answer him. Jaina held fast to her staff, the red light of the brazier burnishing Anduin's face. Silently, she turned and regarded Azeroth spread before her on the table, how well a map represented lands, but how poorly it described the people, the little tiny things that truly made up a whole entire world. "I have not forgotten," Jaina murmured, eyes fixed on Zandalar. "But I also remember that your father once warned Vol'jin to uphold honor or be ended. I wish more than anything, my king, to see your reign endure, and for it to be remembered fondly. And more than anything, for you to be remembered in the same breath as your father. Difficult decisions have to be made. And I trust Tyrallian and Ilaria to know where the line of decency is and not to cross it." Jaina had thought the argument over, but Anduin stood firm, watching her intently. His gaze never wavered.
"Would their statues preside over our city because they are without honor?"
Jaina need only blink to feel as if she was standing in Thunderbluff again, flush with victory and the optimism that often came with it. After all, they had just managed to rescue Bane Bloodhoof from the dungeons below Orgrimmar. A nigh impossible feat. And yet they had done it. Thrall had not shared her optimism, wary of her desire for a temporary alliance.
"What's different this time?"
"We are."
"People change," Jaina said heatedly. She rolled her shoulders back, proud of that change, proud of who she had become and who she believed him to be.
Anduin considered her words, but withdrew further into the corner, holding out his hands to the brazier, as if her words had somehow chilled him. The thick curtain of his yellow hair swung before his face, concealing his expression.
"People do change. But I trust Ilaria and Tyrallian, despite what misfortunes have befallen them. Stormwind would not exist without them. They are woven into the very fabric of our kingdom's tales."
There would be no swaying him. That much had become clear. She turned to go, leaving him with one last murmured plea.
"Clarity and time are the final editors of that story, Anduin. I would know."
Chapter 12. Atalgral.
"What do you think of her? The bold Ava." "Say it with me. The bold Ava."
"Has a certain ring, doesn't it?" Flynn Fairwind cackled, slapping the mainmast vigorously as he turned his chest to the wind and breathed deep, a serene, almost religious glow about his face.
"Christened her myself. The old name was, to be frank, rubbish. The Prowse. Can you believe it? I mean, I'm sorry, pardon me? The Prowse?"
Matthias Shaw stared straight ahead, convinced that if he said nothing at all and ignored the sailor, like a basilisk desperate for a glance, then Fairwind would be forced to cease his blathering. He was wrong.
"What even is a Prowse? Blimey, sounds like something you pick out of your teeth. No, it's much better this way. Can you believe I won her in a dice game? Who would be stupid enough to wager this gorgeous girl?"
"You,"
Matthias said without thinking it through. "Well, in for a copper, in for a gold."
"And you would be soused."
"Yes, yes, absolutely hammered. Ha!"
Fairwind dissolved into further ridiculous laughter, doubling over as he gallivanted up and down the deck. "Well, well, well. You know me well, Shaw.
Do a bit of digging before we came aboard. What does the dossier on me say, by the way?
Devilishly handsome? Irresistible in every conceivable way?
Crack sailor! Deadly with a blunderbuss?"
The significantly less glamorous answers would have to wait.
Crack!
A fork of lightning, white as alabaster, split the horizon. A moment later, Waves rocked the bold Arva so hard, Flynn wrapped an arm and a leg around the mast to stay upright. Sailors began their calls. Whistles blew. Clouds the colour of slate gathered thick and threatening, just a few miles from the bow. Shaw tumbled to the railing, an old break in his shin screwing up tight enough to squeal. They were in for one hell of a storm.
"We should have another day,"
Shaw spat between gritted teeth.
"Survival weather!"
Fairwind was sober enough to shout.
"Grigsby, to the helm! Keep speed, my lads and ladies! Aim for the flats! Rig out the storm sails and watch the decks! Nobody overboard on my watch!"
Matthias didn't dare relinquish his grip on the rail. He had seen his share of storms while posted in Cool Tirus, and they had taught him that only the cautious and wary survived. Light, but he despised sailing. Give him a good old solid office tucked away behind a false bookcase, a roaring fire and plenty of desk space, the only true creature comforts a spymaster required. His stomach churned. His jaw clacked, his entire body protesting the sudden lurch of the ship as a particularly nasty wave broke against the bow.
"Tides be kind! I hope they're quick enough!"
Fairwind slid to the railing beside him, his lately acquired parrot pet struggling to flap to his shoulder, tossed hither and yon by the oncoming storm.
"Honestly, this is very, very bad! If the storm sail isn't up soon, then we're all well and truly f—"
A wave knocked the words out of Fairwind's mouth, and both men found themselves shocked across the ship. Fairwind landing against the opposite railing with a pained grunt, while Matthias had far less luck, his fingernails scratching along boards as slick as ice before he bypassed the railing and slid right off the edge of the ship. Nothing but churning water beneath him. He watched a gnome holding a sail line, saw overhead, mouth open in a scream, the sound of it drowned out by the thunder of 20-foot waves. Before Matthias could make the steep fall into the sea below, Fairwind managed to clamp a hand around his wrist and began to pull, but his chest slamming into the side of the hull left him breathless and seeing stars. Matthias collected himself, scrambling with his free hand for some purchase on the seams in the hull, while Fairwind braced a foot on either side in the gap in the railing, heaving and sweating, cursing as he at last found the leverage to hoist Matthias back aboard.
"Below deck!"
Fairwind shouted.
"Now! You don't have the sea legs for this, and I'm entirely too drunk. See? Nobody overboard on my watch."
It was an undignified retreat to the stairs. The threat of another wave meant that crawling on all fours was the safest option. Matthias sprang to his feet the moment they reached the relative safety of the sheltered corridor leading below deck. Water washed across the boards at his feet, spilling down into the stairwell, though there seemed to be no signs yet of flooding. When Matthias had travelled down the stairs a ways, Fairwind grabbed a passing sailor. To Matthias it seemed like chaos, yet every man and woman aboard went about their job diligently, even if it appeared as if they were all running in random directions.
"The flats!"
Fairwind shook the sailor by his coat.
"The mist is thick, but Nayla up the crow's nest spotted a gap. We're bringing her around and threading it. Then we should have a safe stretch heading north."
It was a screamed conversation, but both men kept their calm.
"And Melly?"
The sailor grinned and nodded, sodden from head to foot.
"Never seen speed like that in me life, Captain."
He was referring to Melly Spaulding, one of the finest tide sages in Cool Tirus, transferred urgently from the Proudmoore fleet. At first, she didn't seem to fit in well with the crew, keeping to herself, a head taller than the average sailor aboard. But then Grigsby had produced a flute one night, and Melly had come out of her shell, beguiling them all with a run of shanties so beautiful it left almost everyone in tears. Her voice rang out as crisp and haunting as a gust whistling off the waning glacier.
Are we to survive this?
Matthias demanded, ducking out of the cramped stairwell and into the marginally taller corridor. He flattened himself against the wall to let a sailor pass. Fairwind jogged down the stairs to meet him, following as Matthias shouldered open the captain's cabin, the view from the windows nauseating as the ship crested a wave and barreled back down.
No, no, it's all fine, Shaw. Completely fine. We live for storms like this. Keeps us all on our toes.
Fairwind gave a barking laugh, then wiped the salt water out of his ginger moustache.
Hard to find a crew this fit. Melly and Naylor will bring us through. You'll see.
Predictably, he crossed to the well-stocked liquor cabinet in the corner, carefully fishing out a bottle while the ship tossed like an enraged shardhorn.
Just something to settle the gut,
Fairwind assured him, tossing back a healthy gulp from the bottle.
I'm sure, Matthias sighed. We should have had more time.
Smacking his lips, Fairwind kept the bottle, ambling over to the windows and watching the furious crash of the waves. It made Matthias sick to even glance at it.
Maybe your source lied.
Maybe.
Matthias rubbed at his stubbled chin.
Or maybe this is just the opening act, and the real show hasn't even begun.
I hadn't considered that.
Fairwind clutched the bottle.
Well, if your source was right, then this is indeed just a taste. The seas were meant to be impassable, yes? And ta-da! We have passed.
His final word was punctuated with a crack, and then an ominous scattering of shrieks and voices, finished with a desperate pounding on the door.
I may have spoken too soon.
Enter!
Matthias roared. The sailor they had passed going below deck skidded into the cabin, his clothes just as wet, but also somehow singed.
Fire?
Fairwind slammed down the bottle and rushed to the sailor. He was a short lad, hardly more than 20, with a pockmarked face and small but quick-moving blue eyes.
Fire, Swales? How can there be fire?
Lightning, Captain, and...
Never mind!
Pushing him aside, the captain stumbled out into the corridor, and Matthias chased after him, curious to know just how a ship in the midst of a cataclysmic storm could also catch on fire. Lightning, obviously, but surely the waves would take care of any flames. Above deck, they found fires spreading from the charred mainmast to the barrels piled below it. They had come through the rain and the waves, leaving the ship damp but vulnerable. Matthias himself knew how much gunpowder and pitch waited aboard to ignite and blow them sky high.
Well, the fire was a surprise,
Fairwind admitted, tucking a curled forefinger under his chin. Matthias might have warned him of the oncoming footsteps, but didn't, dodging as the woman batted Fairwind aside like a sack of feathers. Melly Spaulding slid across the foam-slicked decks, back to them, as she dropped her head, raised her arms, and with her curious tide sage magic, brought water streaming up the sides of the hull before cascading gently across the deck. One by one, the fires went out, cheers erupting from the sailors as the bald Arva slowed, sailing smoothly out of the black and blue squall behind them.
Well done, Melly! Well done!
Matthias didn't feel in the mood for celebration. He surveyed the damaged mast, the burnt sails and smoking provisions, as well as the thickening storm growing like a cancer across the sound. They had passed into Zandalari waters, and he couldn't help but think that the storm had been specifically summoned to keep them out. Who possessed magic like that? And where would they find them?
Sir, message for you, sir. I mean, a shark. A thing for you, sir.
Swales again, this time wet, singed, and carrying a wind-up shark. Gnome technology fit for passing covert messages, even at sea. Much trickier to spot than a carrier pigeon.
Is it always like this with you?
Fairwind chuckled, watching Matthias crack open the shark, revealing a bundle of tiny rolled notes.
These are fraught times,
Matthias muttered.
I don't cease being spymaster simply because I'm on a boat.
He trusted the seafaring sorts to see to the damaged parts of the ship, retreating back below deck to see what his spies had uncovered abroad. This was not the business one conducted in front of prying eyes, and while Anduin assured him that the entire crew had been carefully vetted, Matthias knew the operation had been put together hastily, not allowing much time for lengthy observation of the crew.
Bit paranoid, are we?
Fairwind had followed him, and not subtly, banging into every door and wall available with his drunken weaving. He was going to use up all the usable air if he kept sighing so much, so Matthias simply charged ahead into the cabin, desperate for a relatively stable chair and a long think. Taking the seat far, far away from the liquor cabinet, Matthias seated himself comfortably, tucked beneath the painted portrait of a one-eyed, four-toothed goblin. Bold Arva herself, the ship's namesake, one of Flynn Fairwind's goblin first mates, killed, allegedly, in a tragic harpooning accident. Matthias listened to the return of the familiar mundane noise of the ship sailing at a relaxed pace, gulls crying outside the windows, and the waves forming an almost hypnotizing rhythm that one had to lean into or risk seasickness. Unrolling his messages, Matthias found that Fairwind was not put off. No, indeed. The pirate made himself comfortable, leaning back in a chair until the edge tapped the window pane, his boots kicked up casually on the table.
That from your girlfriend?
Matthias snorted.
Hardly. Intelligence reports from my agents within the Horde.
Ooh, very spicy,
Fairwind giggled, nursing his beloved bottle again. Finally, putting down the booze, Fairwind cleared his throat, reading the room.
Very paranoid.
He regarded the pirate dryly above the first unrolled message.
Just because we signed an armistice with the Horde doesn't mean we aren't watching them. Only a fool mistakes peacetime for complacency.
So then, what's new with the Horde? Any betrayals are brewing?
Matthias skimmed the messages quickly. They were written in a code illegible to anyone not trained in his specific style of shorthand, efficient and cautious. He hadn't been able to successfully embed enough agents to cover every single member of the new Horde Council, but had trusted them to choose their targets once they had reached Orgrimmar. Narcilla Keensight, codename Lancer, had chosen to focus her attention on Lorthamar Theron. Lancer, an old blood elf contact from the Uncrowned, had no loyalties to the Horde or Alliance, but only to gold, which Matthias provided her regularly. Her intelligence always proved worth the price. With a captive audience, Matthias read aloud the message, speeding along.
Lorthamar spends his days at study, though I often observe him gazing listlessly at nothing, then scribbling something in the margin of his book, reading.
This was the way an agent marked down time when nothing of note occurred.
Another 5 days of reading, still reading, no progress. At last, I managed to access one of his tomes when he left to dine. It appears he is either composing poetry or notes of a more intimate nature. Beside a passage about holy energy, he writes, "My dusk lily bends more each day toward the sun."
Fairwind broke into laughter.
Dusk lily? I am confused, yet enchanted. Is there more?
Not about the flower, sadly. But she does describe an incident at the Horde Council meeting with the Zandalari Queen. Something of real substance. An assassination attempt by a troll. So somebody within the Horde wishes harm against Queen Talanji.
Matthias set the message aside, pleased that he had managed to have eyes on the assassination.
Could explain the storms,
Fairwind mused, running his finger idly in circles around the mouth of the liquor bottle.
How so? If someone wants the Queen dead, then maybe she put the whole continent on lockdown. Nobody out or in until they find the assassins.
Matthias frowned.
That is annoyingly reasonable.
Why, thank you.
This one is from a goblin contact, Krazet the Bishop.
Fairwind spat out half his swig of booze.
Krazet! The Krazet! I know Krazet! Spooky little fellow, liked to gamble in Freehold. Called himself the Bishop because he would get three sheets and say, "Oh, lads, I'm a bit slopped." But it just sounded like, "I'm a bishop!"
Calmly, Matthias clacked his teeth together and forced himself not to kick the table out from under Fairwind's feet. Problematically, the pirate was right. That exact fact existed in Crass's dossier.
"I miss that guy,"
Fairwind went on.
"Lost my old parrot Bongbong to him in a card game. Always wondered what happened to that bird."
"Yes, well, Kraz thinks the assassination attempt really gummed things up for the Horde,"
Matthias informed him, scanning the message and translating it.
"The Queen left in a huff. They've sent their own spies after her. A troll shaman called Zakan." "Interesting. They must not be as solidly loyal to the Horde as we thought."
"How did you get Krazet to turn and snitch for you, if I may ask?"
Fairwind smirked, derailing Matthias's thought. It had been so long ago he struggled to recall.
"Parrots. A weird amount of parrots."
Shrugging, the pirate hugged the liquor to his chest.
"He hasn't changed a bit." "Hang on. Isn't it a bit crass that they sent a spy after that troll queen? She nearly died and now they don't trust her? Maybe she's in cahoots with Sylvanas, eh? That's what we're here to investigate, right? And if the Horde don't trust her, then maybe we're all onto the same thing."
He really didn't have time to give an introductory espionage class or time to point out that we weren't onto anything, but Stormwind Intelligence was. But then again, given their situation, there was little to do but wait and strategize.
"The Horde might not be our friends, but they're not stupid. In my experience, a conspiracy is easy to spot once you know what to look for. They probably just sent a spy as a precaution. A smart one."
There was a soft, nervous rapping at the door.
"Who wishes?"
"Yeah!"
Matthias glared at the pirate, but Fairwind was already grinning ear to ear, bouncing his boots gleefully on the table. The Tide Sage, Melly, poked her head in. Tall and sturdy, she had neatly braided her reddish-brown hair in a crown across her head. Points of sunburn reddened her dark skin.
"Beg your pardon," she murmured. "There's another storm coming on. I wanted to talk to you about it, about this weather. It can't be random, and this is no magic I know of. It's like they know where we are. It's like they sent these ragers just for us."
Chapter 13. Nazmir.
"What a pit!"
Sera Moonwarden sneered, pulling her foot up out of the mud and listening to the resounding squelch.
"A blessing that this post is only temporary."
Beside her, Nathanas stood stock still, ignoring the visible cloud of flies gathering around his head. He often wore a subtle cologne to ward off the scent of being neither living nor dead. Many found the complete absence of scent unnerving. Cira had only just grown accustomed to it herself. She did not handle the bugs as gracefully, batting at them while they gathered in ever-thickening swarms.
"Where are they?" Cira added, annoyed.
"Patience, Warden. Patience."
She had little on a good day, even less when she was forced to stand knee-deep in rotting mud. The frog marsh, a strangely painful reminder of how undead she truly was. Here, life roared at her from every direction, from the damp trees draped with green curtains of moss, to the crabs clicking their way up and down the shore behind them, to the deafening chorus of frogs and insects, robbing any chance of a peaceful thought. Life. It was everywhere there. Brash, audacious life. It probably smelled green. Not an inch of it went uncovered, in vines or nests or pond scum. Through the trees ahead, a herd of river beasts snorted and huffed, the brass section of the teeming band of chittering, birdsong and ribbits. It was, in a word, loathsome.
"We'll be eaten alive," she huffed, swatting a dozen bugs before all the words had left her mouth.
"There."
Nathanas pointed to the same trees that concealed the river beasts. Long, dripping strands of moss made the beach feel claustrophobic. The four dark rangers spread about to stand watch dutifully endured the stinging of bugs and stinking of the bog.
"Do you see them?"
he asked. Cira squinted.
"They move like shadows along the forest floor, and being shadows, they will continue being very useful to us."
She marked movement among the tall roots jutting out from the base of the trees. Trolls, cleverly smeared in mud, crept toward them, nearly invisible in the jumble of bushes and fallen logs in the swamp. Cira would not argue about their usefulness. They had already had to move the banshee's wail out of deep water to avoid the deadly storms raging along the coasts.
"They can come out of hiding," she snapped. "They called for this meeting."
"I happen to agree."
With a smirk, Nathanos whistled with his fingers in his mouth, alerting the Zandalari rebels that he had noticed their presence. They stood, one by one, their leader among them slowly making her way to their location with a pronounced limp. Cira somewhat liked the witch, Apari, for they had both been betrayed by the one thing that had always defined their lives. For Cira, it was her worship of the goddess Elune. For Apari, it was her loyalty to the Zandalari crown. For the seriousness of her injury, Apari navigated the swamp deftly. They met in a clearing not far from the sands, the Widow's Bite leader arriving with her bulbous tick pet on her shoulder, a small entourage of 12 or so guards, and her ever-present lieutenant, the tall black-haired troll called Teo. Apari's white hair had been streaked with mud to hide her identity. None of the trolls wore the distinctive white and black robes of the insurrection, but rather nondescript rags and bits of armour. Only Apari and her bodyguard, Teo, broke away to speak with them. The troll witch leaned her weight onto her good leg and pressed her palm to her heart.
"Greetings, pale rider."
"At last," Nathanos replied shortly. "I realize it must have been difficult given your limitations, but next time I expect promptness."
Her eyes flashed.
"I've no limitations you need worry about, pale rider." "Indeed. At least you have understood our need for secrecy. We cannot risk venturing further inland. If Zandalari loyalists lay eyes on us, then our plans are forfeit."
The witch waved away his words impatiently.
Have ye brought our payment? You are hardly in a position to make demands,
Nathanos snorted.
But I am eager to be out of this swamp.
He twisted at the hip and gestured Ranger Vizorin forward. The dark-haired ranger brought forward a small enameled chest, silently placing it on the neutral ground between the trolls and Blightcaller. Aboard the ship, Cyra had seen them preparing the payment, a collection of gems, jewellery, beautifully hammered metal necklace plates, small flagons of rare spirits, and daggers. It struck Cyra as slightly excessive, giving their dwindling resources, but Nathanos had made clear that this was the price of a successful mission.
Soon,
he had assured her aboard the Banshee's Whale not an hour earlier.
Where we will be going, none of these trifles will matter at all.
Cyra slapped at another swarm of insects buzzing around her head, watching as the witch's bodyguard knelt and flicked open the chest with one finger. No smile. No thanks for their generosity. No reaction at all. Cyra simmered, looking to Nathanos, who revealed as little as the black-haired troll.
This is not what I want.
Apari shook her head, sneering.
This is not what we agreed upon.
Clearing his throat, Nathanos calmly signalled for Vizorin to return. She did, and with equal serenity picked up the chest and returned to her sisters behind them.
Insulting,
Cyra murmured. Perhaps she should not have. At once, the witch fixed her piercing turquoise eyes upon Cyra. An instant later, Cyra felt a sensation like a thousand spiders skittering down her back. She shivered, but refused to tear her gaze away. Just a witch's trick, she told herself. Nothing more.
Now, Nathanos intervened. This is a simple misunderstanding. What would you have from us instead?
Apari grinned, showing a set of yellowed teeth sharpened to points, the ends blackened by the foul, strong spirit the Zandalari distilled in charred vats. She hobbled forward, looking Nathanos up and down as if he were a prize cut of meat. Whatever came next, Cyra mused, would not make him happy.
Your messenger said you want to kill Eloa.
Apari nodded. Her eyes lit up, the idea clearly exciting her.
You want to kill Bwansamdi, but you can't. Not without us. This no easy thing, what you ask. He must be weakened first. Believers and tribute keep him strong, but without faithful followers, he be vulnerable. His shrines be protected by powerful magic. The tribute I need from ya will dispel that magic.
Nathanos hurried her along, at last reaching a state of visible impatience.
Go on.
It will require something precious, she continued.
Pointing to Vizorin and the chest, she flapped her hand and shrugged.
That might be precious to some, but not to you. You must give up something painful, something irreplaceable.
What we offer should be more than sufficient.
Nathanos stood firm.
You are not in a position to bargain.
The witch was stunningly bold. Cyra could give her that. With a theatrical sigh, the troll witch began to turn around, avoiding her bad leg, and refusing help from her bodyguard as she began rounding up the members of the widow's bite. For a moment, Cyra remained certain it was just a bluff. But no. The trolls regrouped and slowly disappeared back into the dense foliage of the swamp.
A moment.
The trolls paused, looking to their leader. Apari waited, only offering a glance over her right shoulder. Before Nathanos could relent and submit to their demands, Cyrah took him by the elbow, lowering her voice and tilting her head toward him.
Wait!
But he was already pulling a chain out from under his heavy black coat, a green and gold badge, warped and faded with time, hung from the tarnished necklace. An officer's badge? A remnant from war long since forgotten? Cyrah couldn't say. Nathanos and Sylvanas had once served Silvermoon. He so tactically gifted that he had been raised to the rank of Ranger Lord in the Far Striders, an achievement no other human had managed. The Dark Lady herself had been the one to give the promotion. The Dark Rangers serving Sylvanas had told the tale many times at sea. It seemed to be a favourite. Was this the badge recognising as much? Though his eyes always pulsed with the same steady crimson glow, Cyrah saw that dim for a moment, fading just like the old etched memento.
What are you doing? Cyrah whispered. We cannot simply give in to every demand and roll over like trained dogs. They will think you weak.
At that, Nathanos curled his lip, eyes now as hot and bright as his flaring rage. He seemed to collect himself, breathing hard. His strength, it seemed, was not to be questioned. Cyrah nearly recoiled, but he only pushed the hair back off his forehead, his gaze burning into her with the same furious intensity.
You will learn the value of silence, or I will teach it to you.
That seemed to satisfy his fury, and when he looked at her again, it was as if she were no more than a pustule on his foot, something he loathed to notice, but must. Cyrah stewed in indignant silence as he pulled at the chain around his neck, breaking it, before closing the gap between them and the troll witch, holding out the badge for her to take. Apari might have been severely injured, but she moved swiftly then, her arm but a blur as she tried to snatch the necklace from his palm. Nathanos, however, was ready for her, and quickly trapped her hand there before she could take the payment.
This is no trinket, witch. If you fail to destroy the lower shrines as you have promised, then there will be severe consequences. You may have conjured a few clouds off the coast, but payment this dear demands results.
Cyrah grinned. There. That was the blight caller she knew. While the witch threw back her head and laughed, Cyrah noticed a shadow moving just behind Apari and her bodyguard. Had that always been there? Cyrah moved her hand to her side, tucking her fingers around a dagger, preparing to strike. The thing suddenly propelled itself up into the air and then flopped back down, landing in a puddle with a plop. Cyrah smirked. Just a frog. It waited for another moment before taking another graceless leap.
This,
Apari nodded, a serene smile concealing her sharpened teeth. Even her tusks were yellowed and muddy, but she seemed strangely beautiful in that moment, almost angelic, as if by just touching the necklace, she had been imbued with a new bloom.
This is what the spell requires. There be the power of longing in it, of pain. It will do, Pale Rider. It will do.
We assault the first shrine tonight. Wamsamdi's effigies will burn, and every loss hastens his final hour.
She turned to her bodyguard with a cackle, showing her the badge and necklace.
What was that?
Cyrah asked, following Nathanos as he rounded up the Dark Rangers and headed for their dinghy. He could threaten to teach her the value of silence all he wanted. She was not going to stop speaking her mind. His shoulders were slumped forward as if he had suffered a defeat.
It doesn't matter now. It belonged to her, didn't it?
Nathanos stopped and sneered, adjusting the quiver buckled across his chest.
Remind me when this is over to drown the witch in this bog.
A rustling in the swampy undergrowth made them both freeze, and all eyes fell on the tumbled shrub in the muck not far from Apari's feet.
Assassin!
One of her followers shouted. Cyra drew her blade. Nathanos reached for his immense carved longbow. Then a single spear soared across the reeds and into the bush, loosed by Teo with perfect, deadly aim. She stooped over to the spear and tore it out of the undergrowth. A fat, wet toad hung limp from the sharp end.
Kragwa the Huge inhabits these swamps, and he be sympathetic to the traitor queen,
Teo spat, lifting up the skewered frog for all to see.
His little spies are everywhere. Could be this one is just a toad. Could be he hopping away to make mischief for us.
She snickered and licked her muddied lips.
Either way, lunch.
Chapter 14. Orgrimmar. Thrall pushed away the platter of steaming roast.